Early Britons by Isabel Hill Elder. It has been said that the only excuse for writing a book is that one has something to say which has not been said before. That this claim cannot be made on behalf of these podcasts will be very evident to the listener as he proceeds, since it is a compilation from a variety of sources from which evidence has been brought together to support the belief that the civilization of the early Britons was of a high standard and that they did not deserve that contempt with which they have been treated by many historians, nor the odious names of savages and barbarians by the supercilious literati of Greece and Rome. When evidence, admittedly fragmentary, of the real conditions in these islands from the earliest times has been brought to life throughout the centuries, it seems almost invariably to have been rejected in favour of Roman teaching. In his History of Scotland, the Reverend J. A. Wiley, LLD, says, quote, "We have been taught to picture the earliest conditions of our country as one of unbroken darkness, a calm consideration of the time and circumstances of its first peopling warrants a more cheerful view." Close quote. By examining the available evidence, it may be possible to obtain this more cheerful view, and to show that in the darkest eras of our country, the rites of public worship were publicly observed. It is ever true to say that the history of a nation is the history of its religion and its attempts to seek after God. Wilford states that the old Indians were acquainted with the British Islands, which their books described as the sacred islands of the West, and called one of them Britashtan, or the seat or place of religious duty. The popular idea that the ancestors of the British were painted savages has no foundation in fact. It was a custom of the Picts and other branches of the Celtic and Gothic nations to make themselves look terrible in war, from whence came the Roman term, savage. The painting was in reality tattooing, a practice still cherished in all its primitive crudities by the British sailor and soldier. Far from these ancestral Britons having been mere painted savages roaming wild in the woods, as we are imaginatively told in most of the modern histories, they are now, on the contrary, as disclosed by newly found historical facts given by Professor Waddle, known to have been, from the very first grounding of their galley keels upon these shores, over a millennium and a half before the Christian era, a highly civilized and literate race, pioneers of civilization. The universally held belief that the British are a mixed race has prevailed during many centuries. This belief, however, is now fading out of the scientific mind and giving place to the exact opposite. Britons, Celts, Gauls, Anglo-Saxons, Danes, and Normans, when warring with each other, were kinsmen, shedding kindred blood. Professor Sayce, at a later date, in one of his lectures, observes that he misses no opportunity of uprooting the notion that the people who form the British nation are descended from various races, all the branches that flowed into Britain being branches of the self-same stock. Not a single pure Saxon is to be found in any village, town or city of Germany. Our Saxon ancestors rested there for a time in their wandering to these islands. Dr. Latham says, quote, "Throughout the whole length and breadth of Germany, there is not one village, hamlet or family which can show definite signs of descent from the continental ancestors of the Angles of England." Close quote. It was against this race, now in possession of the whole of southern Britain, that Caesar led his legions. The Belgae, the Atrebates, the Parisii, and the Britanni were all British tribes, having kinsmen on the continent, yet moving westward, who had fought against Caesar in the Gallic Wars. It is noteworthy that during the occupation of Britain by the Romans, the inhabitants led a life as separate as possible from their invaders, and according to Professor Huxley, when the Romans withdrew from Britain in AD 410, the population was as substantially Celtic as they found it. Huxley, in 1870, in the earlier years of the Irish agitation, applied the results of his studies to the political situation in Ireland in the following words in one of his lectures. Quote, "If what I have to say in a matter of science weighs with any man who has political power, I ask him to believe that the arguments made about the difference between Anglo-Saxons and Celts are a mere sham and delusion." Close quote. The Welsh Triads and the Chronicum Regum Pictorum, as well as the Psalter of Cashel, give us the chief early information about the inhabitants of Scotland, and all agree as to the racial unity of the peoples. Much, however, as they fought each other, this unity is recognised by Thierry, Nicholas, Palgrave and Bruce Hannay. The Britons were renowned for their athletic form, for the great strength of their bodies, and for swiftness of foot. Clean-shaven, save for long moustaches, with fair skins and fair hair, they were a fine, manly race, of great height. Strabo tells us that British youths were 6 inches taller than the tallest man in Rome, and they were powerfully built. They excelled in running, swimming, wrestling, climbing, and in all kinds of bodily exercise. They were patient in pain, toil, and suffering, accustomed to fatigue, to bearing hunger, cold, and all manner of hardships. Bravery, fidelity to their word, manly independence, love of their national free institutions, and hatred of every pollution and meanness were their notable characteristics. Tacitus tells us the northern Britons were well trained and armed for war. In the battlefield, they formed themselves into battalions. The soldiers were armed with huge swords and small shields, called short targets. They had chariots and cavalry, and carried darts, which they hurled in showers on the enemy. Magnificent as horsemen, with their chargers gaily caparisoned, they presented a splendid spectacle when prepared for battle. The cumulative evidence is of a people numerous, brave, and energetic. Even Agricola could say that it would be no disgrace to him, were he to fall in battle, to do so among such a brave people. Further south, similar conditions prevailed. The Romans, led by Plotius and Flavius Vespasian, the future emperor and his brother, assailed the British and were met with the British stupidity, which never knows when it is beaten. The British have been, from all time, a people apart, characterised by independence, justice, and a love of religion. Boudicca, in her Oration as Queen by Dion Cassius, observes that though Britain had been for centuries open to the continent, yet its language, philosophy, and usages continued as great a mystery as ever to the Romans themselves. The monuments of the ancient Britons have long since vanished, with the exception of Stonehenge and other places of Druidic worship. Yet Nennius, the British historian who was abbot of Bangor-on-Dee about AD 860, states that he drew the greater part of his information from writings and the early monuments of the old British inhabitants. Our early historians were undoubtedly acquainted with the Book of Annals, written in the vernacular tongue, which was substantially the same as the Saxon Chronicle. Nennius disclaims any special ability for the task of historian set him by his superiors, but is filled with a keen desire to see justice done to the memory of his countrymen, saying, "I bore about with me an inward wound, and I was indignant that the name of my own people, formerly famous and distinguished, should sink into oblivion and like smoke be dissipated. It is better to drink a wholesome draught of truth from a humble vessel than poison mixed with honey from a golden goblet." What were once considered exaggerated statements on the part of Nennius, Geoffrey of Monmouth, and other early historians are now discovered to be trustworthy. In their day, these writers were regarded as historians of repute. Many of the ancient British writers were professed genealogists, men appointed and patronised by the princes of the country, who were prohibited from following other professions. It was left to a later age to throw doubt on their veracity. Since it is the nature of truth to establish itself, it seems the reverse of scholarly, who disregard the evidence of ancient reports as embodied in the Welsh triads and the writings of early British historians. Milton says, quote, "These old and inborn names of successive kings, never to have been real persons, or done in their lives at least some part of what so long hath been remembered, cannot be thought without too strict incredulity." A great deal of history, so-called, has come down to us from Latin sources, whose one object was, from the very first, to make us believe that we owe all to Rome, when in fact Rome owes a great deal to us. So much error has been taught in our schools concerning the ancient Britons that it is difficult for the average student to realise that the British, before the arrival of Julius Caesar, were in all probability among the most highly educated people on the earth at that time, and as regards scientific research, surpassed both the Greeks and the Romans, a fact testified to by both Greek and Roman writers themselves. In all the solid essentials of humanity, our British ancestors compare to great advantage with the best eras of Greece and Rome. Loomisden has shown in his treatise on the antiquities of Rome that many of the fine actions attributed by Roman historians to their own ancestors are mere copies from the early history of Greece. It is unfortunate for posterity that the histories from which modern historians have drawn their information were written by hostile strangers. That they have been accepted all along the centuries as true is a striking tribute to a people who, valiant in war and fierce in the defence of their rights, think no evil of their enemies. Truly, has it been said, that an essentially British characteristic is the swift forgetfulness of injury.
You're listening to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
That Britain had an indigenous system of law centuries before the Christian era is abundantly clear from the ancient histories of our islands. The lawgiver, Molmutius, 450 BC, based his laws on the code of Brutus, 1100 BC. He was the son of Cloton, Duke of Cornwall, which was and continued to be a royal dukedom, and is referred to in ancient documents as Dufan Val Molmut, and because of his wisdom has been called the Solomon of Britain. Quote, "Centuries before the Romans gained a footing in this country, the inhabitants were a polished and intellectual people, with a system of jurisprudence of their own, superior even to the laws of Rome, and the Romans acknowledged this." Close quote. We have it from the great law authorities and from the legal writers Fortescue and Coke that the Brutus and Molmutine laws have always been regarded as the foundation and bulwark of British liberties and are distinguished for their clearness, brevity, justice and humanity. The original laws of this land were composed of such elements as Brutus first selected from the ancient Greek and Trojan institutions. A Trojan law, mentioned by E. O. Gordon, decreed that the sceptre might pass to a queen as well as to a king, and this law was embodied by King Molmutius in his code and remains an outstanding feature of the rulership of these islands. The liberty of the subject, so marked a feature of British government today, runs from those remote times like a golden thread throughout all the laws and institutions in this country. King Alfred, it is recorded, employed his scribe, Asser, a learned Welsh monk from St. David's, whom he afterwards made abbot of Amesbury and bishop of Sherborne, to translate the Molmutine laws from the Celtic tongue into Latin, in order that he might incorporate them into his own Anglo-Saxon code. The manorial system had its beginnings in Celtic Britain, and were so deeply rooted in the soil that when the Romans came, they were wise enough in their experience as colonists not to attempt the redistribution of the old shires and hundreds. King Alfred's ideas of rulership maintained the earlier and sometimes unwritten laws of Britain in these words, quote, "A king's raw material and instruments of rule are a well-peopled land, and he must also have men of prayer, men of war, and men of work." Close quote. From the earliest code of laws, known as the Molmutine, the following are appended as examples. There are three tests of civil liberty: equality of rights, equality of taxation, and freedom to come and go. Three things are indispensable to a true union of nations: sameness of laws, sameness of rights, and sameness of language. There are three things free to all Britons: the forest, the unworked mine, and the right of hunting. There are three property birthrights of every Briton: 5 British acres of land for a home, the right of suffrage in the enacting of the laws, the male at 21, and the female on her marriage. There are three things which every Briton may legally be compelled to attend: the worship of God, military service, and the courts of law. There are three things free to every man, Briton or foreigner, the refusal of which no law will justify: water from a spring, river, or well, firing from a decayed tree, and a block of stone not in use. There are three classes which are exempt from bearing arms: bards, judges, graduates in law or religion. These represent God and his peace, and no weapon must ever be found in their hands. There are three persons who have a right of public maintenance: the old, the babe, and the foreigner who cannot speak the British tongue. From time immemorial, the laws and customs differed from those of other nations, and that the Romans effected no change in this respect is very plainly set forth by Henry de Bracton, a 13th century English judge of great experience. He was thoroughly acquainted with the practice of the law. His notebook is our earliest and most treasured of law reports. Judge de Bracton states, "Whereas in almost all countries they use laws and written right, England alone uses within her boundaries unwritten right and custom. In England, indeed, right is derived from what is unwritten, which usage has approved. There are also in England several and diverse customs, according to the diversity of places, for the English have many things by custom which they have not by written law, as in diverse countries, cities, boroughs, and villes, where it will always have to be inquired what is the custom of the place, and in what manner they who allege the custom observe the custom." Another point on which Britain differs from other countries is that she has ever maintained the common law, which holds a person under trial innocent until proved guilty, whereas the continental nations maintain the civil law, which holds him guilty until proved innocent. Molmutius, the first king in these islands to wear a crown of gold, is said to have founded the city of Bristol, which he called Caradore, the city of the chasm. His son, Belinus, who succeeded him, built a city where London now stands, which he called Cartroy, and also the first Thames embankment. He constructed a sort of quay or port made of poles and planks, and erected a water gate. That gate, the only gate admitting into London on the south side, became Belinus Gate or Belin's Gate. Belinus lived to the age of 80. When he died, his body was burned. They did not call it cremation in those days, and his ashes were enclosed in a brazen urn, which was placed on top of the gate. Henceforth, it was Belin's Gate, and it requires no undue stretch of imagination to see that Belin's Gate became Billing's Gate. Billing's Gate enjoys the proud distinction of being the first port of London, the only port of London at that time, and thus the men of Billingsgate became the first Port of London authority. Cambria Formosa, the daughter of Belinus in 373 BC, greatly promoted the building of cities. She is said to have taught the women of Britain to sew flax and hemp and weave it into cloth. Her brother, Gwogan, first built the city of Cambridge, which he called Carguergan. In these early times, Britain was a wealthy country, with fine cities, a well-organised national life, and an educated and civilised people. The so-called Roman roads in Britain were constructed centuries before the Romans came to these islands. The Dover to Holyhead Causeway, called San Wedelin or the Irish Road, later became corrupted into Watling Street. The San Ickin, later Ickneil Street, led from London northwards through the Eastern District, and San Achman from London to Menevia, St. David's. These were causeways, or raised roads, not mere trackways, as sometimes erroneously stated, except where raised roads were impossible, and this accounts for the term Holloway in some parts of the country. Our roads were begun by Molmutius, circa 450 BC, and completed by his son, Belinus. On their completion, a law was enacted, throwing open these roads to all nations and foreigners. There are three things free to a country and its borders: the roads, the rivers, and the places of worship. These are under the protection of God and his peace. In this law originated the term the King's Highway. Writers who maintain that the British roads were simply unmade trackways seem unaware of the fact that the British were skilled charioteers. This fact, without other evidence, should go a long way to prove that the roads of ancient Britain were hard and well made. Charioteering is not brought to perfection on soft, boggy trackways, nor are chariots built without wheelwrights and other mechanics skilled in the working of iron and wood. Only once before, in the war with Antiochus in 192 BC, the Romans met with similar chariots, but never in any other European country. The British chariot was built after the Eastern pattern, adorned with carved figures and armed with hooks and scythes. British chariots were prized possessions for the Romans. Diodorus Siculus in 60 BC states, quote, "The Britons live in the same manner that the ancients did. They fight in chariots, as the ancient heroes of Greece are said to have done in their Trojan Wars. They are plain and upright in their dealings, and far from the craft and subtlety of our own countrymen. The island is very populous. The Celts never shut the doors of their houses. They invite strangers to their feasts, and when all is over, ask who they are and what is their business." Britain, long before the Roman invasion, was famous for its breed of horses and the daring and accomplishment of its charioteers, and after the arrival of the Romans, the large space given by their historians to the wars in Britain demonstrate the interest felt in them by the whole empire. Juvenal could suggest no news which would have been hailed by the Roman people with more satisfaction than the fall of the British king Arviragus, or Caractacus, a direct descendant of King Molmutius. Hath our great enemy Arviragus, the car-born British king, dropped from his battle throne?
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on thedailystormer.com.
Tacitus and Strabo described Londinium as famous for the vast number of merchants who resorted to it, for its widely extended commerce, for the abundance of every species of commodity which it could supply, and they make note of British merchants, bringing to the Seine and the Rhine shiploads of corn and cattle, iron and hides, and taking back iron, ivory and brass ornaments. At Londinium was considered by the Romans as the metropolis of Britain, is further established by the fact that it was the residence of the Vicar of Britain. The abode of such an office clearly marks London as having been a seat of justice, of government, and of the administration of the finances, which consequently contributed to its extent, its magnificence, and its wealth. Britain was, in fact, from at least 900 BC to the Roman invasion, the manufacturing centre of the world. The Abbaye de Fontenoy proved that the Phoenicians, the name by which the tribe of Asher was known after conquest of the Phoenician territory, had an established trade with Britain before the Trojan War in 1190 BC. Admiral Himilco of Carthage, who visited Britain about the 6th century BC to explore the outer parts of Europe, records that the Britons were a powerful race, proud-spirited, effectively skilful in art, and constantly busy with the cares of trade. Nor was Ireland less forward than Britain, for from the ancient Greek records it would appear that trade routes both by sea and land existed in these very early times, the latter route being across Europe through the territories of the Scythians. A more curious belief of the Greeks was that the inspiration which led to the institution of the Olympic Games was derived from the observance of ancient Irish festivities. The British farmer had a market for his produce beyond the shores of Britain. We learn from Zosimus that in the reign of Julian in AD 363, 800 pinnaces were built in order to supply Germany with corn from Britain. When the Romans invaded Britain in AD 43, they found the inhabitants in possession of a gold coinage and of beautifully wrought shields of bronze and enamelled ornaments. Fine specimens of richly enamelled horses' trappings may be seen in the British Museum, and the bronze shield found in the Thames near Battersea, adorned with enamelled designs. Rice Holmes describes it as the noblest creation of late Celtic art. The beautiful brooches discovered in different parts of these islands clearly demonstrate that the Britons were skilful and artistic metal workers, and in the centuries of Roman domination, the Celtic patterns did not die out. A peculiarly Celtic type is the dragon brooch, representing a conventionalized writhing dragon, often magnificently inlaid with enamel, and recalling in its vigorous design and curvilinear motifs all the essential qualities of late Celtic art. Thus, the native tradition of metalwork continued under Roman rule to flourish and to produce types which were not merely Roman but recognisably Celtic. In a further description of these brooches, Mr. Collingwood says, quote, "In the true Celtic spirit, the ornament on the trumpet head is often made with eyes and nostrils to resemble the head of an animal, but however the brooch is finished in detail, it is always a masterpiece of both design and manufacture." Enamelling was an art unknown to the Greeks until they were taught it by the Celts. Dr. Arthur Evans tells us that the Romans carried off some of the Britons to Rome to teach them the art of enamelling as well as that of glassmaking. Stukeley, giving an account of a glass urn discovered in the Isle of Ely in the year 1757, observes that the Britons were famous for their glass manufacture. The early Britons were workers in pottery, ternary, smelting, and glasswork. In the excavations of Glastonbury, well-made instruments of agriculture were found, such as tools, files, safety pins, and also the remains of wells and bridges. The British tin mines were, from the earliest times, world-renowned, Diodorus Siculus states. These people obtained the tin by skillfully working the soil which produces it. Herodotus speaks of the British Isles under the general term Cassiterides, or the Tin Islands. Bede mentions copper, iron, lead and silver. Gold, too, was mined on a small scale in Wales and on a large scale in Ireland, where was situated in early times the centre of the gold mining industry. Bede mentions also, as semi-precious, the jet for which Whitby is famous for even now. The lead mines of Britain were worked long before the Roman occupation, and it is believed that during the partial domination by Rome, the mining continued to be carried out by Celtic workmen. Dr. John Phillips, the geologist, stated in 1855 that without due consideration being given to the lead mining industry, our ideas of the ancient British people would be altogether conjectural, derogatory, and erroneous. Derbyshire was the chief centre of the lead mining, and is so mentioned in the Domesday Book. Eumenius, AD 266, private secretary to Constantius Chlorus, states, "Britain is full of skilled craftsmen." The coins of ancient Britain are worthy of more than a passing notice. Numismatists tell us that our ancient British types cannot amount to many less than 400 in number, of which possibly 200 may have inscriptions. This variety is to be accounted for by the fact that each tribe had its own stamped currency in gold, silver, and bronze. Canon Lytens states, quote, "It is to be remembered that the earliest British coins are not imitations of the Roman coinage. They much resemble the coinage of Philip of Macedon, Alexander the Great, and the Greek and Eastern mintage." Dr. Borlase, in his Antiquities of Cornwall, asserts that the wheel under the horse, seen on coinish coins, intimated the making of a highway for carts, and that the wheel is common on the coins of Cunobelinus, 14 BC, on those of Cassibelinus, 51 BC, and also on the Cornish coins from which their character appeared to be older than the rest. Sir John Evans devotes 64 pages of his standard work, Ancient British Coins, to the coins of Cunobelinus and the history of his reign. That Cunobelinus, the Cymbeline of Shakespeare, was a man of education and refinement is well borne out by his coins, universally considered to be a true index and reflection of the mind. Numismatists tell us that the Cunobelinus types are by no means a Roman type and could hardly have been struck except by express command. The coins of Arviragus, son of Cunobelinus, are, where they are included, the gems of every collection. The horse, sometimes thought to have been introduced as a national emblem by the Saxons, is one of the most common types upon the coins of the ancient Britons. M. de la Sauze, in describing the gold coin assigned to the British druid Abaris, who visited Greece, mentioned by Hecataeus, states, quote, "I have been induced to modify my assertion on more than one point, and I particularly recognise religious ideas peculiar to the Celts, expressed on their monetary uninscribed types." Close quote. The palm trees on the coins of the southern Belgae, who settled in Kent, Sussex, Hants, Wiltshire and Dorset and Devon, proclaimed the eastern origin of these people. From the modern pictorial representation of our ancestors, we are expected to believe that their dress consisted of an animal skin fastened around the waist, and that they wandered, thus scantily clad, about their island home living on nuts and berries. Boudica, queen of the Iceni, the inhabitants of Norfolk and Suffolk, was described by Dion Cassius as a woman of commanding appearance. Her stature exceeded the ordinary height of women. Her aspect was calm and collected, but her voice had become deep and pitiless. Her hair, falling in long golden tresses as low as her hips, was collected round her forehead by a golden coronet. She wore a tartan dress, fitting closely to the bosom, but below the waist expanding in loose folds as a gown. Over it was a clammy or military cloak. In her hand she bore a spear. In these descriptions of native dress, it is interesting to note the early use of the tartan. A British hooded cloak was evidently regarded by the Romans as a superior garment, for in Diocletian's Edict of Prices, issued in AD 301, the price of the British cloak was the highest on the list, with the exception of the Gallic. If the price was high on account of the quality of the wool, the statement of the epigrammatist Martial in AD 60 is given as substantiating that, among other attractions, Britain was, for wool, past compare. Ireland kept pace with Britain in the farming for wool, both for export and domestic use. Quote, "The Irish cottiers were always warmly clad in their own homespuns." Close quote. The Briton, in battle dress, was an impressive figure, being clad precisely as were the men of Gaul, clean-shaven save for long moustaches, with fair skins and fair hair, gorgeously clad in breeches, bright-coloured tunics and woollen cloaks, dyed crimson, and often of a chequered pattern, with torques, armlets and bracelets of gold, shields of enamelled bronze and swords of fine workmanship. They presented a splendid spectacle when prepared for battle. The Britons appear to have been also importers of cloth. According to one authority, Phoenician cloths of Beirut were largely worn by the inhabitants of ancient Britain. At Beirut, our patron, St. George, held for a time an important post under the Roman government. A torque, or gold collar, was worn by the wealthier inhabitants, and worn also as a distinguishing sign of eminence. Specimens of these torques have been discovered from time to time, and may be seen in various museums, notably Dublin National Museum and in private collections. A very good example, acquired by the late Duke of Westminster and deposited at Eaton Hall, was found at Bron Zion Carawis Mill. It is 32 inches long and weighs 24 ounces.